All right, everybody, welcome back to This Week in Startups. I'm Jason Calacanis, an angel investor and podcast host here in Austin, Texas. I used to say Silicon Valley last year, now I say Austin, Texas. And with me, my co-host, Alex Wilhelm. How are you, sir?
I am fantastic. We have an amazing rundown today.
Yes,
we do. And we also have NVIDIA earnings after the bell. That's going to come out, of course, after we record this, Jason. But I am just bursting with excitement. I mean, this is going to be, I think, an earnings report that really sets the tone for the next couple of months. It's going to tell people where we are on the bullishness hype cycle for AI. So I'm kind of counting down the minutes right now until Jensen tells us if there's going to be Christmas in technology or just coal in our stockings.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Vanta. Compliance and security shouldn't be a deal breaker for startups to win new business. Vanta makes it easy for companies to get a SOC 2 report fast. Twist listeners can get $1,000 off for a limited time at vanta.com/twist. Open Phone. Create business phone numbers for you and your team that work through an app on your smartphone or desktop. Twist listeners can get an extra 20% off any plan for your first 6 months at openphone.com/twist. And Sprig, the product experience platform that generates AI-powered opportunities to continuously improve your product at scale. Visit sprig.com/twist to book a demo and get a $75 gift card.
So let's just get into it. Sure. They're expected to report $33 billion in revenue. Yeah, if you put that number times four, you get to $130 billion a year. And the data center revenue is $29 billion of that. If you didn't know, NVIDIA used to be a company that made graphic cards for gaming. That was basically their business. That's what they were known for. If you were a video game nerd, you would sit there and you'd buy an NVIDIA card if you wanted to get your frame rate up when you were playing a desktop game. Somewhere along the line, people took those GPUs, graphical processing units, and started using them for cryptocurrency. So then they had two line items, and cryptocurrency, I think, for a time, you know, was driving the stock. Those two little businesses, that was their TAM, total addressable market. And we're going to talk about TAM a lot because I just saw a great clip of Bill Gurley talking about TAM. I think maybe we'll put that for tomorrow, but that's an industry term for, hey, what's the market size you're going after? And you can do all kinds of fun things once you know the TAM of gaming and the TAM of crypto. Well, you can kind of figure out what the total addressable market is, how many customers there are, how much they're willing to spend. And then you can do interesting things like who has a certain percentage of the market. And then how much is the market growing year over year? And that can give you some ideas of where the company's going. Why is this so flawed, Alex, when it comes to looking at NVIDIA at that time?
I know we're going to get to the Uber example tomorrow, but I'll just kind of tease it for everybody. One way to think about Uber back in the day, but before it was big, when it was small, was to look at the taxi market and say, okay, the taxi market is X dollars, Uber will get 30% of it. So its revenue ceiling is Y dollars. The thing is, a really good product makes the market much larger. Uber made the taxi market larger. iPhone made the smartphone market larger, etc. So if you have a technology that breaks out, for example, NVIDIA GPUs in the data center context, you can suddenly go from a company doing a couple of billion a quarter to dozens of billions a quarter.
Right. And I call this market manifestation. And I got that term from induced traffic. You know, I remember when I lived in Los Angeles, they would always be adding a lane to a highway. They'd be like, hey, you know what? The 405, it's getting a little congested here at the 405 and the 10. Let's add some bigger off-ramps. And they did these spectacular off-ramps. And I remember reading about it, Alex. These were going to change everything. Uh-huh. These off-ramps, instead of one lane getting off in a tight turn, they were going to have two lanes, and they were going to be a giant wide turn onto Wilshire Boulevard or Olympic or Santa Monica Boulevard. So when you got off the 405, instead of having, you know, this little quarter mile circle of one lane with 10 cars in it, let's say 20 cars in it, sure, you would have, you know, a mile with 40 cars in two lanes. So you'd have 80 cars getting off instead of 20. You went from 20 cars getting off to 80. And that would make the traffic flow because you could get more cars off quicker into that queue to get onto Santa Monica Boulevard. You know what happened?
Yeah.
But people started to realize, hey, trapped on the 405 has been easy breezy. Maybe I'll buy a house a little deeper into the valley, get a little more bang for my buck. Mm-hmm. Because, hey, the 40-minute commute, I can go an extra exit or two out, and it's kind of reasonable, so I'll get the cheaper house. Or, hey, you know what? I love this restaurant in Santa Monica. I live in the valley, or I'm in Venice, and I want to go to a restaurant in Culver City. Yeah, I'll zip across and go to that restaurant. It would induce more traffic, and it never ended. So that's what Uber did. In this example, though, NVIDIA became the choice for doing large language models and inference, I guess, on the margins as well. And these H100 servers just started doing bigger and bigger machine learning tasks. Large language models come out, and suddenly everybody in the tech industry sitting on mountains of cash realizes, hey, we can't buy anything. So here's the other trend, right? The wrath of Khan, which is coming to an end. The wrath of Lena Khan said no M&A. That means all this cash builds up. Nobody's buying Whole Foods. Nobody's buying, you know, WhatsApp. So what are you going to do with the money? You might as well build some servers. You might as well stand up a server farm. It's a good use for it. Maybe a stock buyback. And that's when 29 of the $33 billion that NVIDIA is expected to announce tonight is going to come from data centers. They just let that sink in. 90% of their revenue now comes from a product or a business line, which was not really on the top of people's minds, but 5 to 10 years ago, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And Court, can we get that table back up on the screen for a second? Because I want to make a point to underscore what Jason is saying here, which is that the scale of NVIDIA's revenue, I think, kind of occludes or hides how quickly it came to be. Because you hear that number, you think, okay, well, how much revenue does Apple do or does Microsoft do? Whatever. But Jason, if you look at this chart, just observe the jump from the first quarter of their fiscal 24 to the second quarter of their fiscal 24. People not watching the video, NVIDIA's data center revenue went from $4.3 billion to $10.3 billion in a single quarter. And then it went to $14.5, $18.5, $22.5, $27, and then today expected to be $33. That is still accelerating, Jason. It's still getting much bigger very quickly. And that's why I think this earnings report matters so much. There's a lot of enthusiasm right now in the market in a post-Trump context. The Lena Khan tenure is coming to an end. There's still a lot of investment hype and a lot of excitement about what's going to come. The vibes are good, in other words.
Yeah.
And I think that NVIDIA will either maintain that or really hurt it.
So give me the case for hurting the vibes. What could cause, the stock to tank? What could cause people to lose faith? What would be the narrative or the plot lines or the vibes that could make people go, you know what? Maybe this is overhyped and coming to an end.
Yeah. So I think two things there. One, if the company just meets expectations, like I believe we saw in the preceding quarter, we could see its stock drop 5-6 points again. People are expecting a beat. This is a company that is valued on growth. It's expensive by a couple of traditional metrics. People really believe in it, so it's being valued as such. The reason why I think it could harm the vibes if it misses or just barely meets expectations is that that implies quite a lot about the rest of the industry. NVIDIA's quarter-to-quarter revenue numbers, Jason, are a proxy for the investment that big tech companies, the hyperscalers, are putting into their data centers, which are a proxy for market demand for AI models, AI inference, and essentially just the health of the AI economy. So NVIDIA is kind of down the pipe a little bit, but it should tell us what's going on upstream, and it's one of the best indicators we have. So that's why I think it matters so much for the software picture, if that makes sense.
Founders, do you want to sell to bigger customers? I know you do. You got to get that ACV trending up, and you want to push your churn down, right? Sounds good. But to sell to those big buyers, you need to clear all of these compliance checks. You know that. That means you got to have things like SOC 2 sorted out. What's SOC 2? It's a standard and ensures that companies keep their customer data safe. And if you aren't SOC 2 compliant, you can kiss those big deals goodbye. You're not going to land the Lighthouse customers. You're not going to be able to operate at the highest end of the market. But Vanta makes it really easy for you to get and renew your SOC 2 compliance. On average, Vanta customers are compliant in just 2 to 4 weeks. Can take months without Vanta. And they automate compliance for GDPR, HIPAA, and more. So, you can sell to bigger customers in whatever markup your startup is going after. Vanta is going to save you hundreds of hours of work and up to 85% on compliance costs. Stop slowing your sales team down and use Vanta. Get $1,000 off at vanta.com/twist. That's vanta.com/twist for $1,000 off your SOC 2. This quarter, are they on a fiscal quarter or are they on a calendar quarter? I'm curious. This is Q3 fiscal 2025 or 2024? Am I reading
2025.
This
correctly? Yeah. So this is, we're in their next fiscal year, a bit like Microsoft. They're offset by a couple of quarters.
Got it. Okay. So this is going to be really interesting. We've never seen a company grow large amounts of revenue in this way. The last quarter was $30 billion. Oh, I can't believe I'm saying that. And the year earlier for Q2 was $13 billion. So they more than two times their revenue that quarter to that quarter. Q3 last year, $18 billion. This year, $32 billion. So it's going to just under double, right? So this crazy growth is slowing, but it's still significant. And we talked about before on the program, there have been a bunch of people looking at round tripping as a technical era, as a technical term for self-dealing or insider retransactions. They invest in a company, that company buys servers with NVIDIA's money, but those numbers were kind of small. Then there's accounting issues. When do you recognize revenue? Mm-hmm. So a lot of the revenue here, my understanding, is baked in because somebody will put it in order. You have a company like X.AI, Elon's X company. They bought a lot of H100s. They stood them up incredibly quickly. Okay, those all got delivered in a quarter, but they probably have future ones coming in. And then you have people like Amazon, Apple, Google, and Meta, probably programmatically buying X number per month. My understanding is Jensen's approach is we just take your order and we fulfill orders and when orders are received. But I don't know how the money works. Do they get the money ahead of time and they get to sit on it? It would seem like they have the unique ability in the world to dictate terms. And I wonder if, you know, how much cash they're sitting on now and what they require in terms of people giving them money in advance to lock in those. One could argue that they could give people two options. One, you put a 10% down payment on, you're in the queue. Mm-hmm. If you want to be in the VIP queue, you put down a full deposit, 100%, and you go to that. So I would run the company with two queues that, you know, whatever, 25% down queue, and then you get stuff after that. And then the priority queue, which is you pay 100% upfront. I don't know exactly how they do it.
So I'm looking through their last quarter's earnings, because again, people were recording this right before the Q3 fiscal 25 numbers. But if we look at their deferred revenue, which Jason, I believe is where they would put prepaid contracts, essentially, it's not that much money. It's actually at the end of the last quarter, just $1.7 billion worth of deferred revenue. So to me, that doesn't imply that there's a lot of chicanery going on here. And I'll just point out that the investing community, Court, if we could have that table pulled up real quick, the investing community is not concerned about this. As you can see from here, NVIDIA is once again the most valuable company in the world, beating Apple, beating Microsoft, beating Alphabet, beating Amazon, beating Aramco, beating Meta. So while you and I, because we're nerds for financial documents, are a little concerned about possibilities of round tripping or what to do with the VC fund, as you mentioned last time, the street doesn't care.
Great. Awesome. Okay. So we are going to get those numbers and we'll have a live show tomorrow, Thursday, because instead of doing a Friday show, I'm going to be taping all in on Friday. So you get your all in on Saturday, but we moved up this week in startups to Thursday. So I don't have to tape two episodes in one day, which is exhausting for me. One day is great. It's like a workout. Two a day, too much.
Whenever I do two records in one day, I walk into the house afterwards and my wife's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, I had to talk for 3 hours. And she's like, oh, you poor thing.
She's
but
like,
it is, it's very tiring.
Well, it's mentally stimulating. You and I get to have a conversation here, but all in sometimes tips in from just a conversation into just outright sparring in a cage match. Especially if things like Ukraine come up or Trump or whatever political discussion. So for me, this is like a delightful conversation that can become a little bit, spicy, let's say. And then on that one, I'm the moderator. Here you get to play a little bit more of the moderation role. Yeah. And I get to kind of shoot a little bit more here to your point guard, and we do the pick and roll. Over there, I'm doing a little more point guarding, which is also exhausting.
Yes, it's much harder. People have asked me, do you prefer to be a panelist or a moderator? And the answer is so obvious. Being a panelist is great. You show up with your shoes untied, you sit down, someone puts a mic in your ear.
Ooh, right. You shoot.
Right. Easy.
They pass you the ball, you shoot.
Yeah.
Man, coming down the court, having two guys double team you, and you're trying to zip around and get somebody open, and you have to keep your entire peripheral vision open. Hey, where are the opportunities here for other people to score? Takes a lot of work. All right. So that's NVIDIA.
Yeah.
Let's move on. Anything else we should be looking for there, or anything notable, or just we'll talk about it tomorrow when it comes
We'll talk about it tomorrow. I think that's enough on that, because we'll get the numbers. We'll do a better deep dive. But that's the state of play for 4 p.m. today for On the Ledger. Okay. Jason.
By the way, the number one thing I want to know, just as a project here, is when does NVIDIA have a competitor? This is my big question. When do we think there'll be a disruptive competitor, and you'll see a leading, this is what I'm looking for,
okay,
a leading company, a leading customer, one of their lighthouse customers, let me say it that way. When will one of NVIDIA's lighthouse customers, that's a technical term in our industry, or a customer so pronounced that other people are guided to your product because of it, like a lighthouse guides people to shore safely, having XAI or having OpenAI or having Amazon Web Services as your customer that would guide other people to the safety of an H100 in NVIDIA's term. So when does a lighthouse customer flip to another product?
Okay.
That's what I'm looking for. That will be the disruptive moment we should all be looking for with NVIDIA. And it will come first in the form of an announcement. Then there'll be a startup that tries it and gets a lot of attention for doing it. And then there'll be a competing cloud computing offering. So look for that little cohort. That's when you know the NVIDIA story is going to have complications.
Yeah. Well, just to pick a Twist 500 company, Etched, they're making chips that are literally purpose-built for the transformer architecture for LLMs, which is a wager, by the way, on that maintaining its primacy in how AI models are built. But I love it because if they're correct, they're going to be a huge company and could, to your point, Jason, snag some real market share. I don't think we'll see hyperscalers stop buying NVIDIA chips altogether, but I would amend your what to look for by saying, when does a lighthouse customer for NVIDIA start to buy large amounts of a competing chip? And of course, Amazon has its Trainium 2 chips coming out. So there is some other names on the agenda. Jason, before we get to a guest, though, I want to talk about AI training and data, because there's a little bit of news here from the Twist 500. And it's that I don't think we actually got to this on the show, but Talbot, one of two companies that we added that are dealing with building a marketplace between content providers and AI models that want to use that data, raised a Series A, a $24 million Series A, quite large. And they said as part of that, that they have customers, they have data, and they have AI companies on the platform. So progress there, pretty good. And then also ProRata.ai, a new company to me backed by Mayfield, just secured a $130 million valuation because it's doing the same thing over in the UK.
ProRata.ai.
Yes.
ProRata being your share of something and your ability to buy those shares in the future. That's the term we use here in the Valley. So fair compensation and credit for content owners in the age of AI. So this is not ProRata as in you get, if you own 10% of a startup, you get to buy 10% of the next round. This is compensation for content owners. This is amazing. We need to have attribution. We need to have citations. Exactly as I had said on this very program, I think 2 years ago, at some point, citations will be required and permission will be required. Citations are in the latest version of ChatGPT everywhere. Perplexity has always had some of them. And in the new search product that ChatGPT, or I'm sorry, OpenAI is doing, their search feature, they have some citations. Some of them are buried, some aren't. So I think this is what we're seeing is the healthy evolution of the ecosystem. And what's going to have to happen is the untraining of models. So if you put Reddit in your model, when you build your next version, you're going to need to make sure that all that content from Reddit is taken out somehow. Technically, that might mean, you know, how do you do that? It's a technical question. I'm not sure how much of a new version of ChatGPT relies on what was indexed previously. And so, yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I know in some models, they just start over, they have all the data sitting there. So then it would just be like, it would be the equivalent of having a library and going in and saying, okay, take all the Stephen King books down, take all the Tolkien ones down. We don't have the rights to those. Take them out of the library. Now open the library to customers. But if all the knowledge was already sucked in and it's got it in there, I don't know how you rip out that scaffolding. That's a really good question for when we have these companies on the pod. One thing I'd like to institute here, if somebody is good enough to be on the Twist 500, let's have the founder on the pod for a quick guest hit. Twist 500 is our attempt to identify the top 500 private market companies. Now, an easy way to do that would be to just look at market caps and put in all the unicorns. We're not doing that. There, you can sort the Twist 500, which is built on Coda,
yes,
coda.io/twist, I think, and you get some sort of free deal. We didn't pick them because they're a sponsor on this podcast. We did because it's a really great tool for doing stuff like this, but it's a database. You can go in there. How many companies are we at right now?
We are at about 110, and due to a snafu, I'm re-adding in about another 10, so we'll be about 120.
All right, going slower than I would like, but maybe this will be our Q4 end of the year project is to ramp up here. Somebody had a baby, and I think has been having a little less sleep. So
we've also been doing a lot of shows. I mean,
oh, that's true. We have been hitting 4 or 5 shows in a week, which I never thought was going to happen. But next year it's going to be 3 shows a week. The sales team hates me because I'm turning down money for that 4th, 5th show a week. But I just, you know, I want to do 3 really high quality shows a week. Let's get that dialed in.
Yeah.
And then maybe we can both get some sleep. All right, let's, you know, we have a, speaking of guests.
Yes.
And you can check out Twist 500, twist500.com. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, check it out. There's a submission form there. Don't email the sales team and ask them to put you on the Twist 500. People selling the ads, if you go through them, it's probably going to be worse for you. That will be like a -1 because we have a Chinese wall, a firewall between the editorial and the ads. You don't get to be on the Twist 500 because you advertise. Okay. But there is a submission form, and there I don't think anybody reads it, but there's a submission form.
It goes to one of my email addresses, I believe. So okay. I will see it.
Founders know that every missed call is a missed opportunity. Customers don't want to wait. They will call someone else if you don't pick up. But if you use OpenPhone, you're never going to miss another customer call. And guess what? It's super affordable and easy to use. People used to spend tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars putting in a corporate phone system. And now for just $15 a month, OpenPhone will give you a business phone line and complete control of your destiny. Want to know who's answering customer calls and how they were handled? OpenPhone can do incredible things like sync with HubSpot and give you AI-powered call summaries, automated responses to ensure you don't miss a single ring. Well, that's all built into OpenPhone. And if you've got an existing phone number, they will let you port it over at no extra charge. Get 20% off your first 6 months. What an amazing offer. At openphone.com/twist. That's openphone.com/twist for 20% off for 6 months.
Let's talk about our first guest today.
Sure.
There's a company, Jason, called Allen Control Systems.
Oh, yes.
They caught my eye on Reddit because I like things that go boom. And then it turned out that they are a venture-backed startup and raised money, I believe, from Kraft Ventures. So I thought, hell, let's have them on the show.
My bestie, David Sachs, backed this company. I remember we had a conversation on All In last year, or maybe 2 years ago, we were talking about, would you back a company? And I remember Sachs kind of waffled a little bit at the answer to the question. And then I found out he actually had, but he hadn't announced it yet. And Steve is here. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it.
All right. I think you might remember that moment, maybe, because...
I do remember the moment. Also, it's good to see you again, Jason. I briefly saw you at the All-In Summit. I was hanging with mostly Jimmy, though, your guy, Jimmy.
Jimmy Donahue,
we're gonna golf together. We're golf. We're about
are
to
you
golf.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Jimmy D is the greatest. Jimmy D and I grew up on the same block in Brooklyn. We had the same crew. He went on with my brother to join the NYPD. The three of us were gonna go on at the same time. Right as I was about to join NYPD, I got accepted to Fordham at the last minute, and I went at night. And there is where, like, the changing cars, the butterfly effect, whatever, happened. And
Jimmy's the man.
Jimmy is the guy, and he does all my security and is awesome. So tell us a little bit about your company. What are you trying to do here? And
Fundamentally, we're trying to change the battlefield economics. So Allen Control Systems, we make autonomous gun systems. And so these are guns that can point and shoot on their own. So the operator, the soldier only has to give a command of what target they want. And then Bullfrog, as you see here, will actually do the rest. It'll slew to the target and then fire the shot.
Wow. And it is an actual assault rifle, it looks like.
Oh, yeah.
That's been mounted. Mm-hmm. So you don't make the gun. You use an existing gun in the world, correct?
Yeah. So we're using a standard M240 assault rifle.
Okay.
It's a standard army gun that's in, most units. It's a very widely distributed gun.
Yeah.
Got it. So you don't have to worry about the maintenance of those guns or building them. They exist in the world already. Is that a 50 caliber on this one I'm seeing here?
That's still the M240. We do have a 50 cal variant coming. So what we make is we cut all the steel. We make all the circuit, the motherboard, the motor control board, all the circuit cards are custom, and then the software. Everything but the gun, basically.
Yeah.
Well, because when I did my tours, Alex, Stolen Valor, I used to man the 50. In my dreams, I manned the 50. My
You're
good
like
friend,
Cuba Gooding Jr. in that one movie, Pearl Harbor, man in the 50 yeah. cal. Yeah, that's
I used to man that 50. I think also Black Hawk Down, they were yelling, man the 50. And John McEwen, my good friend who was a Green Beret, he used to man the 50 caliber. All right. So you have this existing assault rifle. You build a container for it, and then it has a lot of AI. And this is not used to go out and kill humans in the field. This is used for defensive purposes today, correct?
Yeah, so we are starting with the hardest problem, which is hitting a fast-moving, small drone. Obviously, it is a gun system, so the Army will use it for multiple mission sets. But drone warfare is the primary concern right now.
I'm really curious about just the sheer volume of these, because I've actually shot machine guns before, once at West Point, for example, and they are just so indescribably loud. And so I'm kind of curious, does that at all impact how you design systems to go after drones? Because I presume you want to be stealthy until you pull the trigger, but oh my God, once you do, Stephen, they're just insane.
Yeah, that's a good point. So our system is designed to be passive, meaning it's using cameras to find the drones. So instead of a radar detection system, which is very loud, the enemy can see like someone using active radar, and then they can hit an artillery shell to your truck. Our system with just the cameras, before you fire the shot, you can hide. And so the passive nature of it is really good for force protection.
Okay. And then does that mean that it's optical based? And if so, does that mean that you have issues in rain, snow, sleet? Is this a fair weather system, I suppose?
Yeah, no, it should work in all weathers and at nighttime. We use EO, electro-optical, and IR sensors, so infrared. And so we're able to see at night as well. Obviously, if it's really rainy out, that can be a problem. But that's also a problem for many other weapon systems as well.
Let me ask you a candid question here. How long did it take to develop this system? Just in quarters or months or years, ballpark.
I mean, this was a solid 18 months to get it to where the government is buying it now. I would say it's another 18 months, till it's like the best gun on the market that you could buy. Like it's already the most accurate gun in the U.S. right now, but it will be incredible, in another year or two. But yeah, like right now, 18 months.
Got it. So the reason I asked that question is there are bad guys in the world. And if your small team at a startup can build this in 18 months, are there versions of this that have been built by nefarious players, terrorist organizations, bad actors in the world that you have become aware of since starting the company?
Not that I'm aware of. This is I do survey the market pretty often as the startup CEO. This is the first gun that is putting couple bullets on a drone at any like two or three football fields away. So there's nothing like this on the market. There will be, obviously anyone can build anything. This does take a lot of money. Obviously I was fortunate enough to sell my last company to DoorDash, which helped fund a lot of
the
initial.
What was your last company?
It was called Bebot. It was an online ordering point of sale company.
Cool.
Actually backed by Kraft Ventures. So I made them some money when we sold that for a good amount of money.
So you went from point of sale to pinpoint,
Yeah.
A sniping.
Before the restaurant technology, I started my career in the U.S. Navy.
Yeah.
I was a U.S. Naval officer. And actually, Luke Allen, my co-founder, this company's called Allen Control Systems. I named it after my friend. I met him in the Navy. So we worked in the nuclear, it's called Naval Reactors, NAVCO8. So we were the headquarters for the nuclear Navy.
Oh, wow.
That's awesome. And
so I know submarines are powered mm-hmm. by small nuclear reactors.
Yes. Yeah. So we would train
aircraft
all
characters as well. Yeah, aircraft characters as well.
Yeah. So we oversaw from cradle to grave the nuclear reactors on the carriers and the submarines, and we trained the fleet on how to operate.
May I ask a dumb question to Steve? We have big debates about small modular reactors and safety of them. Our military, there are dozens of small nuclear reactors, I believe, on submarines and aircraft carriers, correct?
Yes.
Today?
Yeah, so there's dozens. These are very powerful, you know, reactors on the submarine.
Small in the sense of volume. They are not the size of the giant, you know, spherical cones that we see on the landscape. These are the size of a conference room or 10 conference rooms.
The size of, you know, like 8 conference rooms.
Okay. So it's the size of a couple of tractor trailers inside one of these larger things. And they are safe. Has there ever been an instance where one of these dozens of them have had a meltdown safe?
Naval reactors, we would say we've had in our, 75 years of operation, no reactor accidents.
So when you hear people, you know, hand-wringing, kvetching, whatever, about nuclear reactors, do you just pound your head into your desk?
I'm a strong proponent of large-scale commercial reactors. I think those are the best. I think we need more of those. Small modular reactors, you know, while they look promising, there's a lot of startups doing it. It seems safe. It's not where I would want to be. Like, if I was investing my money, I want to be in the big reactors.
Got it. Why is that?
Economies of scale?
Is just super efficient. They can pump out a lot of power. Like, people are just afraid of them. It's a public perception thing. Mm. Public is a little afraid of them, but you can put these in faraway places and, you know, run the power. So I'm a big reactor guy. The small modular reactors are still, I still think it's to be seen how they play out. That's where I stand.
All right, Steven, I want to get back to drones because we've been talking about drones.
I can talk about any topic, by the way. We can go, I do my own podcast.
That's why you're a good guest.
You want.
All right, so first of all, opinions on the new Opeth album, and do you think they'll return to the real death metal roots of the band, or do you think they're going to stay proggier and more melodic?
Ah, you got me. You
can't comment on death metal?
No, you got me.
Damn it, Steve, everyone should be able to
comment.
Yeah, I just did.
So that's me.
Good job. All right. You want to build products that users love, and we all know product market fit is how you know you've built something special. And if you're hunting for product market fit, you need to understand your users better, right? How else could you boost engagement and drive more conversions for your product? Well, product analytics alone is not going to get you there. So let me tell you about Sprig. Sprig is a product experience platform that generates AI-powered opportunities to continuously improve your product at scale. Let me explain to you how this works. Sprig captures your product experience in real time, and then they use AI to instantly analyze your product and give you real-time insights. This is going to let you know how to make your product better. And if you make your product better, it's going to drive revenue, it's going to increase retention, it's going to reduce churn, all of those good things are going to happen. See why top product teams at Notion and Figma, two of the classic breakout products of the last decade, are already using Sprig's AI to unlock new opportunities at scale. Visit sprig.com/twist to book a demo and get a $75 gift card. How nice. Sprig, sprig.com/twist.
Steven, drone swarms. So we've talked to Skydio. We've talked to other people that are working on both in the air and underwater drones, and they're talking a lot about swarms. And when I look at your system, super cool, love the technology, seems to be able to hit single targets. Is it applicable to drone swarm defense, or is it more we're going to get spare reconnaissance drone that's flying over and knock
that out? This is meant for a drone swarm. So it'll do coordinated fires. So multiple bullfrogs. The bullfrog itself can turn 360 degrees and point straight up in the air. So imagine if the bullfrog's on a Bradley tank, it can do a full protective bubble around the tank, and it shoots very quickly. So, you know, we think we can shoot with one bullfrog up to like 20 drones in under like 15 seconds. Like, it's that fast. Yeah, no. And so, but it's going to take multiple bullfrogs. And swarms could overwhelm it. That is very true. And I think that we will see like 10,000 drones coming at something. You're going to need a lot of guns and maybe some other layered defense for electronic warfare or something else like that.
Well, here's the good news. These things, I'm going to guess the price here. $500,000 per?
$350,000.
Okay. I'm becoming an expert
price,
on this.
By the way, fixed price, not cost plus.
Exactly. So the reason I'm becoming an expert on this is because I have a podcast, you understand. And we had another company on recently that's making out of Providence, Rhode Island, unmanned, basically torpedoes that are only 70,000 compared to like what they would normally cost. So you're part of this new generation of, instead of doing cost plus, hey, you make it, it's got a good margin in it. Maybe there's a maintenance contract or a software license to, you know, keep some reoccurring revenue come in or whatever. But the Army could buy 10 of these. And if you lose five, who cares?
Yeah.
They're disposable at $350.
Exactly. It's a very good price point for them for this kind of exotic technology. And yeah, we hope to, like I said, we're trying to bring that cost curve down. It's so important.
Yeah. I want to go back to the Bradley point, because Bradleys are APCs, right? Not versus tanks.
The Bradley is the Army tank, the big Army tank.
I thought that was the Abrams.
The Abrams and the Bradley, I think, are both.
Anyways, I did not mean to drag us down to NBTs versus APCs. But the point is they're mobile. So if I had an infantry division, say, and I had several different wheeled or tracked vehicles, I could essentially bring full-on drone defense with me for an entire cohort of troops, I presume pretty much any climate. So does this negate the drive we've seen towards more drone-based warfare versus human-driven warfare?
I think when our product really hits the battlefield, which will be soon, it's going to dramatically change how FPV makers think about their companies. We're about to make them look pretty dumb.
Wait, what's an
FPV drone, like a small first-person drone. Like, we're going to...
Oh, first-person drones.
Actually, I have one here. This right here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Those are like the standard DJI.
Yeah, so like these are like, you know, companies are trying to strap bombs to these and then fly them at artillery or Bradleys. Yeah, Bradley is like the smaller, like the Abrams is the bigger tank, you're right. But the Bradley's like tank-like.
So you send one of these with a grenade on it or something a little bit more and you drop it or you kamikaze it in, right?
So exactly. And so we're going to be neutralizing that threat. And I think that the drone makers are going to have to respond some way, because it's really hard to, you know, mitigate a bullet hitting this.
I was just about to say, you can't put armor on that thing, because one, you put enough armor on it to negate a 50 cal bullet, it's going to be too heavy to fly.
Yeah.
And two, I mean, it wouldn't be maneuverable. It would be just a brick in the sky. So it'd be easier to shoot at that point. So is there a way for them to like see incoming bullets and then get out of the way?
We're going to give the drone maker, so like there's startups like Neros doing drone swarms, and then there's Anduril just released the Bolt. Have you ever seen the Bolt M? It's a the Bolt is their cheap FPV by Anduril. It's incredible. It's an incredible product. I really like it. We're actually doing a test ACS versus Anduril next year. There are Bullfrog versus their drone swarms, their Bolts.
Nice.
And so
can we pay-per-view this? This would be a great This Week in Startups pay-per-view. Here's
this,
the Bolt. The Bolt is there. Is it supersonic or no?
No, it's not supersonic, but it's very fast. And so this thing is, they're going to try to see if they can get through Bullfrog and blow up like a Cybertruck or something.
Sweet.
And we'll do that competition. Again, I feel really strongly about how we're going to perform, because if you attach any sort of payload to Bolt, it can't move as fast as it shows in the videos. Like, if there's a 4 kilogram or 3 kilogram bomb on it, like it's a sitting duck for a Bullfrog, I think.
Well, I think what's going to happen in these cases, I'm just going to take a guess here, is it's going to be about kind of like the Iron Dome in Israel is. It's just what percentage can you take down with the Bullfrog? And then how many can they send at once, and can some slide through? So this is just going to be, correct me if I'm wrong, how many get through the net? How many?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things we're doing there. Like, so our company strategy is to make a family of autonomous guns. So Bullfrog is a small caliber M240 based. We're also building an M134 minigun. So it's a Gatling gun version. Ooh. So the Gatling gun can do like 3,000 rounds a minute. So imagine coordinated autonomous Gatling guns. I mean, we're going to put a lot of lead in the air. It will cover the sky.
It is what it is. Yeah.
Cheap. I mean, a bullet is cheaper than a drone, and a drone's cheaper than most other things in the military world. But we're really getting back down to kind of like dollars per kill here.
Yeah. And what happened, the insight really from Luke, my CTO, the brains behind this, is that it's the control systems. That's why the company's called Allen Control Systems. We just found a way to put a bullet on a small drone at 3 football fields away.
Yeah.
And it was just a very hard problem that, you know, we're happy. We're very excited right now.
You're going to put these on sniper rifles, I take it, at some point to get people further away?
So at the longer ranges, what we're doing is a 30 millimeter chain gun. So it's like it's the Bushmaster by Northrop Grumman. My dad actually worked at Northrop Grumman for 33 years. So I grew up around this in the prime contractor world.
How many people in your company right now?
So we're 35 people, adding about 4 engineers a month right now. Just growing.
So what does this say about our military and our ability to compete in the world when we take capitalism, entrepreneurship, and unleash it on the military industrial complex? What does this mean for our ability to be the most important military in the world?
Yeah, I think this is actually I think about this a lot, this question, because if you didn't have the background me and Luke had, and then you hadn't sold a company for a lot of money, we wouldn't have been able to like get the capital to build this product. And I think this is a huge problem in the US right now. So there's a lot of smarter people than even me and Luke that are in universities that have great ideas like Bullfrog, but they can't even really get started to like help the military with these new innovations because the capital constraints to get in, the amount of CapEx you need is so high. I think we're missing out on a lot of new type of weapon systems that we should be building. And the government's not capital allocating into like new innovation like that much. So like I don't really know what the US would have done without like the situation Luke and I just found ourselves in to be able to do this.
We do have the venture industrial complex. And I think the venture industrial complex combined with entrepreneurs taking on the military industrial complex, or at least creating a little bit of competition on the margins, is going to be transformative. And if you look at any top-down government dictatorships I'm referring to, they can move quickly because they can enslave 1 million people, put them into factories like the Chinese are doing with Uyghurs, and say, yeah, Hey, make a bunch of sneakers or drones or, you know, landmines. They can do whatever they want. But that pales in comparison to the innovation and the drive of free men and women and capitalism. And that's why we are going to win.
And I agree 100%. Last thing on that is just that venture capitalists, and this is like one area where like they're really bailing out the government, to be honest. Like without the VC community, we would be really far behind our enemies.
For the venture capital community, this is exactly who should be doing it, because it's risk capital designed for rewards and designed to build better products and services than exist. If the government were to award those people at MIT or, you know, whatever engineering school with just a grant, they would not move as fast than a company run by you or Palmer Luckey or Elon or, you know, pick your great entrepreneur, because they wouldn't have the drive and the competitive nature. And that is what is missing from government allocation. And capital allocation is a competitive sport. It's one of the great underappreciated things. People like David Sachs are competing against Sequoia, competing against Y Combinator, our firm. We're all competing to get deals. The founders are creating a marketplace for us to compete for deals and pay the highest price, you know, and to keep the stock price growing. All that's part of great American capitalism, which at its core is competitive.
Very competitive. I'm a big competitor. Yeah.
That's why you're able to do this in 18 months. If you were working at a school and you had self-selected into a university, academia, the people giving out grants, you would not have the urgency of doing it in 18 months. It's the fact that you were going to run out of money in month 24 that made it get delivered in 18.
You need the pressure. Need it.
I'm curious about the manufacturing element about this, because we're talking a lot about American capital, American ingenuity, American defense. Is the supply chain entirely domestic, and is that possible? And then also manufacturing, how domestic is that?
Yeah, we're going to be doing this all in America. It's mostly currently in America. And the thing is, like, right now, this appropriation, so I do a lot of the lobbying. I live in DC and I do a lot of the, besides fundraising, I do a lot of the lobbying and Hill work. So we're working with Congress right now to decide where we're going to put, you know, some of these buildings.
I mean, this is great, by the way, Alex, because you and I talk here all the time on This Week in Startups about job destruction. Americans who are out there, you were thinking you were going to work in the marketing department or communications or whatever your degree is, maybe even a developer. You know, maybe you need to actually go to a factory and assemble something in the real world. And that's going to create so many jobs in America that we're going to look at this anti-immigration kind of moment in time and think we're idiots. Now, nobody wants violent immigrants in the country. We need another 150 million people in this country in order to man the factories, to staff these factories, to make these weapons, to make iPhones, to make cars, to make rockets here in America. We need to be on an America 500 program, 500 million citizens. Now, we want to do that correctly. I don't know how you feel about immigration, but I do think you're going to have a hard time finding factory workers. No?
Yeah, it's going to be tough. But I think it's a very exciting product, and a lot of people want to come work on autonomous robot guns. So we'll see how we do.
People in a factory building stuff like this make per hour? Like, I know when they work in like a car factory, they make $30 an hour, something like that.
I don't know. I think yearly salaries are somewhere between like 90 and 125.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a great job.
That's a great job.
That's a great job. That's own a home job.
Yeah, it is a really good job.
Have one parent stay home job and raise kids job. Like, that is back to classic American. One parent gets to stay home. Another makes enough money to pay a $2,000 or $3,000 a month mortgage.
We're going to reindustrialize, and the VCs are helping make that happen.
All right, let's go.
Let's go.
I want to squeeze in one more question before we have to let you go, Stephen. We could keep you on all day, but how soon are you going to put together a GoFundMe that I can take some of my money to put into, so that way we can send these to Ukraine?
That you bring it up is I get like all these emails all the time, because I went on Fox Business the other, like a couple months ago for this, and everyone always emails like, "What's the ticker symbol? When can we get in? How do we do it?"
He wants to
fund it to send some to Ukraine to stop Putin from invading countries. What's your position on Ukraine?
I want to just buy Ukraine bullfrogs.
No, you're in. Let's do that. My co-founder will love you for that. When Putin invaded, the first month is actually right when we sold to DoorDash, same month. And he donated a Bitcoin so that the Ukrainians could buy javelins.
Nice.
So you're totally aligned with my CTO. I'll have to connect you guys.
Awesome.
Please do.
Listen, continued success. Yeah. You're hiring 4 engineers. Where can they go? What's your email? Because there's a lot of engineers listening to this.
Yeah.
Working on nonsense at Facebook, trying to get people to, you know, increase the click-through rate on some scam ad by 0.01%, when they could be actually doing something important with their lives, like working at your company.
Yeah, gotta get them. Email Steve. Thanks again. Email Steve at allencontrolsystems.com. We'd love to have you. We're in Austin primarily, but you can be remote. Oh, but most people are in Austin. Yeah, we're South Congress, south of the river.
Great. That's where I am. I'm in Driftwood. Yeah.
I'm down there like twice a month. So you have to come to the range. You should come to the range and see the product.
I would like to come to the range and see this. I'll do a live This Week in Startups from there, then we'll get some Terry Black's beef ribs. You can come too, Alex.
You can't do the drone gun shoot thing.
I'll buy my own ticket.
Who cares?
I got you.
Let's definitely do it. I think you'll really love to get out there. Okay.
I want to do it. All right, Steve. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Everybody go work for Steve, or I should say 4 of you a month. Go work for Steve. And protect this country and protect democracy.
Awesome.
Captain America here on This Week in Startups podcast. He was great. I could talk to him for hours. Let's have Steve back on in 1 year. You know, we have so many great guests that I was like, you know what? Let's try a twofer on This Week in Startups. So let's do a twofer. Let's do a twofer Tuesday coming at you here on Z100, the morning show. Twofer Tuesday. Remember that on the radio?
It's Wednesday, Jason. We all know that.
Twofer Tuesday, in my mind.
Okay, well,
do you remember Twofer Tuesdays on Rock Radio?
I do not. That might predate
Twofer Tuesdays
me.
Were like, okay, coming at you, money for nothing from Dire Straits on a Twofer Tuesday. And after that, the Sultans of Swing, coming at you.
So my version of this was Mandatory Metallica on the local radio station. They would play three Metallica songs in a row at like 9 p.m. or something.
I met the lead guitarist from Incubus
recently.
Yeah, nice guy. Just friend of a friend.
Okay.
And we talked about parenting, and he's a cool dude. Mike Einzinger. I met Mike Einzinger.
Okay.
E-I-N-Z-I-G-E-R. And we just went back and forth talking about rock and roll with our kids and like what bands we were introducing them to. So shout out to Mike Einzinger. This might be a new celebrity bromance I'm having. You know, I have a celebrity bromance once in a while where I meet a celebrity and then I bro out with them.
And then you make them come to your poker games. Then you take all their money.
Hang. No, not money, but, you know, more like just to hang. But yeah, it's a little bit of that.
But interviews, Jason, let's have our next guest on, because this is one that's actually very exciting from the launch perspective. We're going to talk to Rami Abi-Habib, the CEO and co-founder of a company called Querio. Hey, there he is.
Hey, Rami. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thank you for pronouncing my name right. Very excited to talk about the second half of American dynamism, B2B SaaS. It's very exciting.
No pressure, Rami. What are you doing in the world? What did you get done this week? Are you protecting democracy and humanity?
In my own way. Dictators? In my own way, I am producing jobs and I am protecting democracy.
All right. Well, welcome to the program. Tell us a little bit about what you're working on and maybe even show us a little bit about what you're working on.
Yeah, sure. So, great to talk. I'm Rami. We're building Querio. Querio is the best way for teams to work with data. We really try to make sure that everyone can work with data in a way that matches their technical level. I think over the last couple of decades, we've, generally perceived data as a very transactional relationship. You have someone else bring you what you need. Most people can't access themselves. Data literacy is quite low. And year by year, data just becomes more important, right? One of the only jobs that are still higher in demand than supply are data jobs, data scientists, data analysts, etc. So how do you make that new generation tool where those technical people feel like their needs are met and the business people feel like their needs are met without compromise, I think is the biggest thing.
So can you show us, like maybe take the screen over here and show us the product, full disclosure. You went to our accelerator. I'm unsure if you went to Founder University before that.
I did. You made me quit my job. And then after that, I built a company and then got into the accelerator. And now we're here.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe before we even go into your product, let's explain that journey for a second, because, for people who don't know, I found myself as an early stage investor when Sequoia Capital asked me to be their first scout, along with a gentleman named Sam Altman. He did Stripe, I did Uber. And that got me started as an investor. And one of the things I found over the years, Alex, was I got up to 4,000 or 5,000 applications for funding a year. All In broke out, became a public phenomenon, crossed over into, public mindshare, and I went from 5,000 applications a year to 20,000 coming into our database. But the problem was, a lot of those companies, Alex, it was a lot to go through. So now I have 7 full-time researchers and analysts going through those, putting them in a database. Well, they're already in a database, but, sorting through them and meeting with the top 4,000 or 5,000 of the top 20,000. But what we found when we looked at the data, Alex, was half the companies were incredible teams that hadn't incorporated yet, but they had a killer idea, and they had 2 or 3 co-founders who were technical product managers, just awesome. We had no way to engage them. We'd say, let us know when you raise money, I guess. And then I was like, I'm going to come up with a solution. I came up with Founder University, a 12-week course. People come to it. They don't need to be incorporated. We invite 250 teams, and then we'll just invest in whichever 10% to 20%, 25 to 50 companies, will give them $25,000 or $125,000 as their first investor. Because I would like to be the first investor in another unicorn so that people could stop saying I was the 3rd or 4th investor in Uber. And I can just have, and I think your company will be that. Anyway, long story short, this has helped us engage with another 1,000 companies a year and invest in another 100 companies a year because we have a pre-accelerator. That's the setting here. So how did you find out about Founder University?
Yeah. So funny enough, I found about it on X through you actions. I was following and I saw about Founder University. And so I applied. At the time I was working at Amazon, I had a great idea. I was kind of like the personification of Querio as a person. And I worked in a lot of technical and business roles. And me and my co-founder, who I met at UT Austin, actually, I lived in Austin for a few years. And I think Salt Lake and Wimberley is better than Terry Black's, but I'll leave that for other people to judge.
I go to the Salt Link frequency. It's about 10 minutes from here. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. And yeah, applied for university and got in, and ended up, you know, we had built an MVP. It worked really well. Got a lot of good value out of the you know, program. And then we ended up getting investment from the pre-accelerator. And that was really kind of like that big push that made us incorporate. We both committed to Curio full-time, quit our jobs. My co-founder, he had worked as an operator at a couple of exited startups, and it really just lined everything up for us and really gave us that initial push that we needed to keep going.
So just to be clear, my thesis was, hey, if I build this thing, founder university, I might get people to quit their jobs at Amazon or Uber or wherever they are and start their company. And that first 25 or 125K check could be the thing that just, you know, helps them make the jump. And in this case, that was in fact what happened?
Yes. Yes. The plan worked, surprisingly. Yes.
Literally warms my heart that we made a plan, we executed on it, and it happened.
Okay. Which is very rare. That is really rare for a plan to work out, but yes.
I love it when a plan comes together. If you're a child of the 80s, you remember the A-Team. I love it when a plan comes together. I gotta get my cigar out. So show us the product here. Enough with the... We've done the self-congratulatory victory lap here. An idea worked, but let's see what your idea is. Let's make this about
Absolutely.
You now.
I will show you the current version of Curio, and maybe we can talk about how it's going to be changing. But yeah, so first and foremost, Curio is a BI tool, business intelligence platform. It's to help businesses analyze their data and query their data. So today we're going to be looking at some data for Dunder Mifflin. For those not familiar, that is a very famous TV show. Called The Office, so I can ask Curio, you know, who am I? And it should tell me who I am. Of course, I'm going to be the best character on the show, which is obviously Michael Scott. He is hilarious. So yes, we are Michael Scott, regional manager of Scranton, PA. That's fantastic. Pretty much like other classical BI tools, you have things like, you know, dashboards where you can track things that you're creating, that refresh automatically, that you can filter.
What are the classic BI actually, tools? What would the top two or three people would recognize as business intelligence tool?
Looker, Tableau, maybe SAP if you're in a very old organization. Those are kind of like the more larger ones. And you have some new age ones like ThoughtSpot potentially, depending on how modern your organization is. But I think Tableau and Looker would make most people's
business
brain kind
intelligence
of like light
started
up.
In 2000 or so, 2000 to 2010, those companies started to emerge because of big data.
SAP. Yeah, so it's like SAP really started the whole, you know, online chart creation where a data team was making these charts that they could send to their business counterparts for them to track things. That was really like the first big one. Second big wave came with Tableau. They let you actually filter them. Looker lets you look at the tables underneath them. You know, every 5 years, you got a bit more control on the business side.
And this is where an entire career emerged for people who would be in big data. What are the job titles that were created because of this over the last two decades?
It started off with like business analysts who would just analyze business data. Data analysts would be a little more technical. You have the engineers who would actually move all the data around, the data engineers. And then you have the data scientists who forecast, do deeper analysis that became more of machine learning when that came out. And then some ad hoc ones. You have like developer analytics and some random kind of more niche ones.
Okay, so that's great. So this entire industry has boomed over the last 20 years. Alex, to give context, that 10 years before that, we saw things like databases and storage and the internet kind of was the setup to all of this, right, Rami? Like the fact that people had cheap storage, the internet, there was a lot more data recorded. And then people said, well, what's in this data? And a classic example of that would be somebody like Amazon who has sales data. They have website data. Too much
data. 1998 till today, there are so many databases at Amazon. It is crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, you can't fit things in an Excel sheet, right? You have over a million rows. You're getting hundreds of millions of new rows like every hour, every day.
So part of the setup is all this data exists. You have to go to somebody like a developer, get them off of building a product, ask them questions, and wait a week or two. Then you forgot that you put the request in, and then they come back to say, hey, I did about 5 days of work. Here's your data.
Yeah, only for them to not actually be in your day-to-day, not understand the nuance of your question, and then you have to tell them, okay, that didn't pass a sniff check. I think you looked at this wrong. Can you pull it this way instead?
Okay, so that's our setup for your
startup. The average ticket success time at Amazon, fun fact, was about 5 weeks for a general data request. Yeah.
That's like 2 years.
5 weeks.
Yeah, that's an insane amount of time.
It's insane. It's ridiculous.
But Rami, if I understand that the point of Querio is that it brings in a lot of traditional BI tooling, charts, dashboards, and so forth, but it also lets me query it in plain English. So that way I don't have to go to a data analyst or data scientist. I myself, the person in a business role, can do it myself.
Yeah. So that's one part of it. I think, you know, I think it's really great that companies are trying to be more data literate. I think it's great that we're now buying data products for companies. But, you know, you look at Tableau, I think something like 95% of the licenses they sell are just for viewers. You can't even make anything. You can't even drag and drop columns to make charts.
Wow.
And so it's great that we have all these tools. We agree everyone should have access to them, but most people can't actually use them. They can just kind of open them and look at something. And so, you know, we're trying to build that BI tool. We are building it where how do you make the data people's lives better? You know, not only are you going to save them time, how do you make their workflows actually better? Because you want to convince them with more than just you'll have a few less questions. And then how do we make those business people kind of flip that on the head? And instead of having only a transaction relationship waiting, that you get to do some more work yourself. So, I mean, we can jump into a couple of questions, yeah. See how Querio would answer them, but.
Okay. Yeah. So we have some data here in Querio. It's Querio.ai. Just yes. So if you want to go look at the website. And this is year one of your company, basically.
Yes.
And you've built your, what was an MVP when we met, now it's an actual product that people can buy.
Yes, and customers' hands, and people have bought. Yes.
Yes. Wow. Amazing. That's great to see that all happen within, under 18 months. So what can people do with it? Because this is, so you don't have to wait 5 weeks, right? That was when you originally talked to me about it, was like, hey, there's no reason for... 100% of people in an organization should be able to make these queries of the data sets. And we want to make a tool that takes out that telephone game. Yeah.
Yeah. We want to take a tool that takes out the telephone game. That's exactly it. And also a tool that will serve what the current needs are, but even better. So let's start with the one we're generally talking about, which is you don't need to have this telephone game going back and forth between someone technical and getting the context from the business team. So yeah, we have some data. We have some account data, orders data, Dunder Mifflin sells paper products to a bunch of different companies. So we can ask a question like, you know, let's list the top 10 products by revenue and give us their quantity sold. Pretty basic question. So we can ask it. Querio can look through the database, understand how it all joins, understand how it works. It'll tell you what it's going to do in English, write the code for you right after. This is just a SQL query, and you can see it if you're technical, you know, just so you can be sure that it's right. And then just like that, you get your answer. Really quick, you have some classics up, whether you can sort the data, whatever it is, which is really nice. But you can do more than that, right? This is a querying question, like just asking, show me the X of these. It's kind of like clicking through some Excel sheets, but through a database that you can't see. What if we had a question like, you know, are there any salespeople that have to offer some discounts to close a deal? You know, which account managers are offering the most discounts?
I'd like to know that myself.
Yeah. So that's my bet is Michael Scott, probably. He seems like the kind of guy who would offer a lot of discounts. So. Yeah, it's going to join the orders and account table, for instance, on account ID. So it has an idea of how all the tables relate, which is a really complex thing that a lot of data teams struggle with sometimes. And then it's going to calculate the average discount percentage. So just like that, we have a list of all of our account managers, the average discount percentage. It looks like Aaron Hannon is actually number one and Michael Scott is third. So, or actually he's tied for a second.
I like my guy Ryan at the bottom because Ryan just holds the line.
He's Ryan
like,
really does hold the line.
We don't discount. That's it. No discounts. We charge a fair price. He holds the line.
Yeah. And I guess what's really cool with these kind of products, like you could think of AI as the best data scientist that ever existed, but it's the first day at your company. And so the biggest thing we had to solve is how do you get this digital kind of context understanding of how your company and your data works so that it can write the correct queries, right? It's not looking at the rows of data. It's actually just writing the code instructions to pull data from a database. And we do that through something called our knowledge base. And it's basically where, and here it is. It's where we kind of capture all the details of every column, how all the tables join. Usually column names aren't very descriptive of what's actually in them. And I think maybe about like 15% of my time at Amazon when I was working with data was just trying to find it. And so this is great in that end.
So Rami, on that point though, how hard is it to onboard a new customer into this, into Querio? Do they have to change how they upload data into the service or can it parse a variety of different, inbound sources from different companies that might have different approaches to storing their information?
So to start off, how hard it is, it's funny. It's actually the more mature the company is, the easier it is. So if they don't have a data team, they're maybe only running with the CTO, maybe some engineers like flexing, doing two roles, and they don't really have the time to set it up. That's where we can, have a bit more of a manual approach, unscalable things when you're starting off. But data teams are quite used to building things called data models and data catalogs, where they actually kind of document what's in the data to make sure that it works. And we have our own system of how we define things so that they maximize efficiency for the data teams and also the automated AI process. There's nothing they need to change at all. So it's something they just, fill out in their own way. You can also already have kind of schemas of how the data works and how they already join that pre-exist. We have an agent system that can also fill out, do a first pass where they can check. And we can go into more details. But yeah, it's inversely correlated with the maturity of the company.
No, I appreciate that. And then does that actually help your early customer acquisition? Are you dealing mostly with larger, more legacy clients that are therefore easier to onboard? Or are you selling more to startups today that have more of an issue getting set up?
That's a great question. Yeah. So, the whole thing we're trying to build here, which is meeting everyone at their technical level, you can see everything I demoed today is really, really good for those people that aren't technical and need to ask open-ended. And so that process is working really well, but it's a catch 22. Since we are built for those non-technical people, they're also the hardest to onboard. And so the next phase of the company over the next 6 months is we're building out a lot more of these features that those data teams are going to love. And then that'll, increase our ACVs. And then also lower our onboarding times and our sales cycles, which will be great.
Is the way to go to market here, I always like to think about go to market strategies in year one of a company, as you get into year two, you got to really be thoughtful about who is your ideal customer profile. And I wonder if you've given thought to, hey, I use tools like Looker, I use Tableau, and so I'm going to add this to my utility belt and put it into the mix. Or do you think, hey, our ideal customer is somebody who Tableau and Looker are too complicated for, and they don't have it yet, but they do have underlying data. In other words, they're kind of a tweener. They're not like data blind, where they don't care about data. They're just running some small business. They're not data driven organizations, but they're like that sort of mid-sized company. How do you think about which one to go after?
That's a great question. I think I'll start off by saying that any company that needs the internet to run is probably going to need to analyze data.
Okay.
Outside of some niche e-commerce stores, for the most part, it's a fundamental part of most businesses and they can't avoid it at some point. I think we've had customers already leave products like Looker and Metabase and Kibana for us, which mainly means that we are taking the market share. We don't think we're directly competitive. But the idea is not to be part of the belt, it's to give them a solution that actually fits their needs a lot better, which those tools just don't. So it's more the second one, which is to replace those tools and give them functionality and actually consolidate two or three tools instead of just replace one.
See, I think this is a very interesting exercise, Alex. It's one I like to do with founders, is just have this dialogue. So what you're seeing here when I ask Rami a question like this is, I have my own thoughts on it. I like to hear the founder's thoughts on it, and then I can ask another probing question. And this is what eventually results in a board of directors creating a plan. And then that plan is for the next year, and you execute against it. And then you put priorities and resources against a plan. And as Doug Leone told me, hope is not a plan. Plan is a plan. Make a plan. And so now when I look at these things, I have a really interesting, humble approach. I just listen to founders. And when I hear you talk, Rami, it was just like a bunch of things burned in my head. I realize there's some brilliance to the simplicity of your product that even people who could figure out a complex legacy product, and a legacy product tends to be any product over 10, 20 years, any product that's over 10 years is now a legacy product because interfaces change, AI changes, there's so many different ways to do it. And it reminded me of a discussion I was having with a friend of mine. When you get to a certain scale house, Alex, and you've experienced this, I think, with your in-laws and some other folks you mentioned, you will be told you have to install a home automation system like Questron or Savant. These things cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to implement, but on a $10 million home, you're like, well, it's 1% or 2% of the cost of the home. I need something to manage this home. Nobody ever uses them. They're always broken. They require somebody for $200 or $300 an hour to come in and reprogram everything. And you get to have this moment where you have a weird remote control. People come stay at your house. They can't turn on the news or watch the Knicks game or put on music. Every time I buy a new home, I rip this shit right out, Alex. And you know what I do? Sonos and Apple TV.
Yeah.
We're done.
Did you hear that rumor that Apple's releasing like a control center for homes?
I predicted this 2 years ago. We did something. What should Apple do next? If they're not going to do Project Titan, the car, I said the number one thing they should do is home automation, because I use Apple Home. It's garbage. I use Google Home. It's okay. I love Google's drop cams, which became Nest. Yep. They screwed that whole thing up. But I just go with Sonos because it's elegantly simple and it's beautiful. And I go with Apple TV because, again, everybody knows how to use it. And so I think there's something to simplicity and UX and design that you may have hit on that would even make the person who wants to put in the $250,000 Savant system or Control 4 falls in this bucket where you're not allowed to make changes to it. You need a technical person, blah, blah, blah. Ah, screw it. Like, go with elegantly simple. There's something to it.
I mean, you're looking at one of our first customers. They were paying $60,000 a year for Looker, and only the CTO was technical enough to use it.
Oof.
From a seam of 20. And it's ridiculous. And not just that, they paid for a separate tool. They were also paying for Hex because Looker doesn't support Python. So we haven't actually gotten into the non-AI part that we're improving. There are some BI tools like Mode Analytics. They got bought by ThoughtSpot, but the legacy tools don't even support Python natively, which is not an AI thing. They just only do SQL. And data teams are now having to buy a Python tool like a Jupyter Notebook, like Host, and a SQL tool that lets them host dashboards like on Looker. And it's ridiculous. And they're paying six figures at sometimes seed, definitely at Series A, for like three people to have some good data.
How much cheaper can you go compared to those kind of legacy price points? I'm curious how much of a price war we might see as you guys take on these incumbents.
I think the tools are decently complex to make, where there's not going to be like a flood of these really kind of consolidating Python with like good AI agents with good SQL IDs. So right now our average ACV is about, $8,000 to $10,000. Our two newest customers were at the $15,000. Ideally next year we can start reliably closing those $20,000-$25,000.
I would be 50% off as a baseline, I think is the disruptive pricing.
And it's great because if we can get up to their current ACVs, but offer, you know, you can also get rid of this other tool that has nothing to do with Looker.
Now you're 90% discount.
That's such a great value prop. Yeah. And we're going to get more value out of your business team. They're going to be able to self-serve more. You know, you data team or CTO, you're going to have a lot more time on your hands and the other Python work's going to be quicker. There's just a lot of value to claim from so many different ends, which is really nice.
All right, Rami, this has been great. I want to let people know three things. If you, like Rami, are working at a company and you have a great idea, I'm waiting for you, founder.university. Number two, if you have a MVP and you got a couple of beta customers, I'm waiting for you. Launch Accelerator, launch.co/apply. Number three, once in a while, if I have a great company, we will share that company with other angel investors and help them get in early. And that's done through something called the syndicate. I was able to get the IP around the syndicate after I left AngelList. So I have the syndicate.com, 11,000 angel investors. I think 4,000 have actually done a deal with us. We've done 300 of these deals. So go to thesyndicate.com and you might see companies that come out of our programs who are raising small amounts of money at reasonable valuations to kind of get to the next step. If you're a high risk accredited investor, you can join the syndicate. There's a waiting period, like 30 days, and then you have to be accredited right now. Maybe in the future that changes. Thesyndicate.com. Go apply now. And in worst case scenario, Alex, you read the deal memos and you say no to everything, but you get smarter. Rami, thank you so much for including us in your journey. I appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to great things to come.
Thank you. It was great talking to you guys again. And for everyone listening, I highly recommend all the different programs Jason has. I've done pretty much all of them. I am the spokesperson.
You've checked off, I think, three or four boxes so far. Maybe you'll check off the fourth at some point soon. All right. Well done, Rami. And it's Querio.ai, spelt
Q-U-E-R-I-O, similar to query.
Querio.ai. All right. We'll see you soon. Take care, Rami.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Alex, I think we've done enough show for today. We're going to be back tomorrow with a lot of interesting topics. We're going to talk a little bit about exits and IPOs. I saw an incredible stat And I have some great charts that my friend Fawad was sharing with me on WhatsApp. So we got some great stats and charts for you tomorrow. We'll have the NVIDIA earnings tomorrow. Anything else on the docket tomorrow that we should tease right now?
Wouldn't people hate to go over Surface Titan's S1 filing?
Oh,
there's
yes.
a new Microsoft AI deal with HarperCollins. That's pretty interesting.
I'm HarperCollins author for this book right here, Angel. And I want to know about that deal because I haven't gotten a call from Hollis yet.
I don't know if the dollar amount will actually be very interesting to you, but the pitch is. And there's a bunch to get to tomorrow, guys. So if you do love Twist, we are live tomorrow at 12 Central, yeah?
Yeah, 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific, West Coast, or as we would say in New York, the Left Coast. He's at Alex on Twitter. If you know who the main character is or a deep cut of an interesting story, you can always DM him. I assume DMs are open. My DMs are open, and man, are they messy. Or you can just mention both of us, at Alex and at Jason. We'll see you all tomorrow on This Week in Startups. Bye-bye.
Bye.